fries. Wake up. Shake up your business.
Hello, Libby Gore here, and I'd just like to say how glad I am you've dropped by the Enterprise Breakfast Podcast. You know, they say it's the best bits of the week or whatever, but every bit is the best bit. You know, I say that to you every time. In this particular podcast, I thought we might explore what does it mean to be Australian? And when I say that, it's like the Aussie brand. Who are we?
Disrupt Radio.
What picture of us should we paint, do you think, to sell Australia? I'm not sure that's it. Can we still go with the sun-bronzed, blue-eyed, blonde-haired Aussie? You know, laconic, happy to go out, have a good time, happy-go-lucky, good with his hands, with a name variant of Wayne. And for the girls, is she still a sun-kissed, dry-humoured gal with a name variant of Sheila, wryly apologetic for the bloke's behaviour? Does she still speak English and go up at the end of her sentences? Is mate still a friendly word? Got it. Do we still farm? Do we still grow? Do we still fix? Are we abundant with mineral resources, never-ending natural beauty and opportunity for the young? Ugh. Or is our reality now something very different from our Crocodile Dundee brand, by which we still sell ourselves, by the way? Got it. Is the 1970s tomorrow, which is the 2020s today, of a cohesive, multicultural melting pot, a priority on green energy, commercialising medical research against a spine of mineral exports that no longer own the market, whilst the farms ache, the reefs struggle, and the good-natured approach evaporates as a gulf between rich and poor widens? Well, socially, at least we know we aren't all heterosexual. The 2015 plebiscite fixed that, so we entertain more sexual variations than just the missionary and 69er between men and women. And then, in terms of our Indigenous community, it seems no special constitutional treatment from the millions of families of migrants who live here. No. So what does it mean to be Australian? Got it. You know how they say you are what you eat? What about the concept you are, as an identity, what you buy? Yep, I know. It's like shopping trolley judgment here. Bernard Salt, who's a noted demographer in Australia, you know him, he's highly acclaimed, written a million zillion books. He joined us on the program over the course of the last week to actually dissect that. If you look inside our consumer habits, can you glean some sort of new Australian identity shaping itself? If you could put in a word who Australia was, is, by looking in their shopping trolley, by looking at what we buy, what word would you choose, Bernard?
Libby, I would choose groceries at the moment.
What, we are groceries? If you looked at our groceries, but who are we?
I think that who we are and what we're buying is summarised by our grocery shopping.
Yeah.
And for two reasons. If you look at the largest demographic group in Australia, the largest generations, it is the millennials. These are people in their 30s and now pushing into their early 40s. These are people not starting families, but actually growing families. They're primary school kids. They're moving into the family stage of the life cycle, preteen. And so certainly in a cost of living crisis, they are very much focused on groceries, the necessities of life, but the necessities of family life. That's the stage that they're in at the moment. 6 or even 7 million people in that age group. I think that Australia is being shaped in 2024 by the buying habits of the millennial generation.
The buying habits of millennials. And you reckon that they're buying groceries more than they're buying anything? I mean, everybody's got to buy groceries.
Well, everyone's got to buy groceries, and they always have to buy groceries. But at this time, I think that their grocery buying has shifted to include young children, of course. So it would be nappies and baby food and everything else that goes with raising a young family. You could also say that it's the the core of life. They're looking for their forever home. So in terms of what they're buying, yes, it's the very pragmatic stuff of groceries, but also looking to move on perhaps from an apartment into a home with a front yard, a backyard, three bedrooms or four bedrooms, for in preparation for the eventual arrival of teenagers by the early 2030s. That's the stage of life that they're in at the moment.
This is very interesting. Firstly, I want to draw your attention to the beauty and majesty of the word groceries. It's a good one, isn't it?
I don't know where it comes. It probably comes from Latin somewhere, I imagine. But it's very practical stuff of life. And I think that, you know, this is very, you know, it's brought home at the moment with everyone very much focused on the cost of living and, you know, people citing the cost of different grocery items. It's a very practical measure of what's on people's minds at the moment, I think.
But because people always buy groceries and everybody buys groceries, you're saying that Australia is being shaped and its policies are being shaped by the grocery baskets of a particular sector of the country at the moment. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm actually saying that it's the millennial generation moving into their late 30s, early 40s,
them,
that is the most powerful consumer market that is rising at the moment.
Yep.
And you can take one indicator of that group would be their grocery shopping, I suppose. It's that group. There are three groups that are actually shaping Australian consumer patterns at the moment. The largest one, of course, is the millennials in their late 30s, early 40s, you know, that family growth, family development stage of the life cycle. People in their 20s, this is substantially shaped by the studentification of Australia. So, you know, cafes, bars, restaurants, I imagine, would be driven by that demographic. And then the third one, of course, is the older X's and baby boomers now in their 60s and 70s. They're the three groups that are set to shape the way in which Australians live, buy, behave over the next decade. You can't get away from that demographic driver of who we are, those three bumps in the profile of Australians.
So I would imagine that the late millennials, that is the 30s, early 40s, and the interests of the late X's / young baby boomers would be in conflict in terms of policy?
I think at different stages of the life cycle, you need different things. I think the focus on housing at the moment is quite understandable when you see an entire generation, 6 or 7 million people moving into the late 30s and thinking, you know, it's time to move to we need more space. And especially now that one of us or two of us are actually working from home. That's one policy, one policy area. But the other, of course, is the baby boomers up in their 60s, moving out of work and into retirement proper. The real issue, I see it, is around 2030 to 2035, when the baby boomer generation move well into their 80s. This is an era of very high cost health care that, you know, it's like a freight train. You can actually see it coming down the tracks. At the moment, you know, the baby boomers are, you know, might be doing a Rhine River cruise or whatever, spending their superannuation that they've saved and so forth. But that next iteration in their life is about high cost health care at scale that we haven't seen before. So, yes, I mean, there's different generations, different times in life require different policy responses, I imagine.
But
I'm not in politics, of course.
No, but I was just thinking, though, but this generation of baby boomers moving into their 80s, they would be different to, say, the needs of my parents when they were moving into their 80s, because this generation, the next generation down, have had better healthcare all the way up. So maybe their healthcare will be changing in terms of maybe they need joint replacements or things like that, but they're not going to be as sick, are they?
Well, I think the longer you live, the different types of
maintenance
conditions, maintenance issues apply. And I suppose we've done quite a lot over the years with regard to drinking and smoking and keeping fit and keeping well and so forth. But the issue for the baby boomers, there's just so many of them. We have never had that proportion of the population aged over 70, let alone over 80 previously. Humanity has not dealt with this. I mean, my my grandparents, you know, two of my grandparents died in their early 60s.
Yeah.
Before they got to official retirement age.
Yeah.
In fact, whereas my parents lived into their late 80s and early 90s, in fact, and hopefully I'll make that as well. But, you know, it's just more people hanging around the later years in the life cycle mean that the requirements shift. And when it's at scale, there is a funding issue that is looming, not necessarily this decade, but very much from the early 2030s onwards.
How interesting. And in terms of the millennials in their late 30s, early 40s that are wanting to put down roots, have a house, do the whole family creation thing, are we seeing movement around the country as they look outside of where they may have grown up in Sydney, Melbourne or Brisbane and moving to regions? Are we seeing that kind of demographic shift?
There's certainly a lot of anecdotal evidence that young people in their 30s, late 30s, are, I don't think you can call 40s young, I think you're more or less middle-aged at that stage, moving out of Sydney. And certainly the rate of growth in places like Geelong and Ballarat are suggesting that there's an overspill from the capital cities. I think this has been enabled by the work from home movement, in fact. So, yes, I do think that there is a spreading, if you like, out of capital cities, not to the far regions, but within striking distance if you need to get to the workplace would be the argument. You know, not every day, but maybe once every 2 weeks or something like that. So, again, this builds my theory that the millennials are thinking about a new housing model, not necessarily an apartment in the city, close to, you know, the hip and happening, whatever it is, but something that is more suited to people that are raising two or three kids, for example.
Perhaps even moving to Tasmania.
Well, yes, moving to Tasmania,
or South Australia,
lifestyle places. I mean, what the way I see it is that, you know, we have five or six capital cities, major capital cities, and then surrounding that is this sort of lifestyle zone, you know, sea change or tree change, commutable but not regularly commutable distances where people can get more value for their money, and they live in a Ballarat or a Bendigo or a Bathurst, as an example, or Mullaney, just outside Brisbane, and live that lifestyle. It is lifestyle, I think, that drives Australians, regardless of which stage the life cycle you're at. You know, we have a great quality of life in Australia, and you know, in the 1950s, we thought, you know, the three-bedroom brick veneer in suburbia was a great life, and it was for the time. Today, we think, well, actually, you know, we want four bedrooms, two bathrooms. I want to be able to work from home. This is our interpretation of modern lifestyle, and that is what I think drives Australians: the relentless pursuit of lifestyle.
So there you go. There's our word. It's lifestyle, isn't it?
Well, that's true. And, you know, there are certain pragmatic restrictions that limit your interpretation of lifestyle.
Of course, Anzac Day was on the horizon this week. Anzac Day, one of the most pious and solemn days on the Australian calendar. But when you look at pious and solemn days on the Australian calendar, normally they're religious. And look what we've done to them. It's all about dollars, cents, Santa, and chocolate. So what is it with Anzac Day and the word Anzac? Have we yet turned this day, which actually is about the commemoration of Australian people who serve in the wars defending our borders, have we actually turned that yet into Brand Zac Day? Joining us is Squadron Leader Michael Veitch from the Air Force Reserves. You'd know him from the D Generation from way back. He's a well-known author, actor and broadcaster. Some very interesting insights into how Anzac Day has evolved. What is it about Anzac Day that keeps it from becoming Brand Zac Day? Or has it already gone down that commodification route? Squadron Leader Michael Veitch from the Air Force Reserves is a well-known author, actor, broadcaster. You know and love him from his many incarnations on radio and television. He joins you to discuss, given he's written so many books about war and about Australian identity in the context of war. Michael, are we at Brand Zac Day point yet, or is Anzac Day still very kind of protected?
Hello, Libby. How lovely to talk to you again. Great question. I think we're still working that one out. Certainly, Anzac Day has changed from what it was when I was a kid. I used to, having had an interest in this stuff all my life, I used to go up there to the shrine and watch the march as a boy. And in those days, I often tell people the participants, i.e. the veterans, used to outnumber the audience because there were so many. I mean, when I went as a kid, there were still thousands of people from World War One, let alone all the World War Two blokes. Now, they've all gone now. So it had to evolve into something. If it was going to still exist, Anzac Day, it had to evolve into something else. And it is a vastly different thing from what it was when I was when I was young. Has it become more commercialized? It's certainly become more, I hate the word, but jingoistic, I think, which is always a danger. I remember Anzac Days as being a very kind of, although there was lots of, you know, noise and colour, it was a kind of a very solemn and dignified ceremony where people just sort of remembered and got together and reflected, and there was a great sort of mateship and comradeship. Now it has evolved into something else, and largely it's people who have not had to thankfully participate in war, celebrating it. So what they are actually celebrating is a very interesting question.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because when you were growing up, we're talking about the 1970s and the 1980s, which is...
Yes, I am that old. Thank you, Libby. There you go.
It's really not so... It's actually the recent past.
It is.
The word that we used then was commemoration. No one would have dreamed of playing a football match on Anzac Day at those times.
The football match. And I know. It's a bit like...
That was a huge conversation with the RSL, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Well, and that's when the RSL was in... People forget the RSL was an incredibly powerful social organisation. And, you know, the old... people listening might remember Bruce Ruxton. I mean, these were powerful blokes of the old establishment that had enormous sway over what happened in our society, and they insisted and they got their way that particularly anything to do with Anzac Day and Remembrance Day on the November 11th were very, very sacred. Now, that's broken down a bit, or quite a lot, really, and I think I can pinpoint one of the moments to it in 1995 when John Howard had the end of World War, the 50th end of World War II parade, which marched, and that was in August 1995, and it marched from Melbourne. Anyway, it marched the other way. All the old World War II blokes started at the shrine and walked into the city. It was like a kind of a one-off unique Anzac Day, but it was such a hit. That's when the pollies started to get on board, and it became a thing that politicians have to be seen to be involved in the Anzac kind of legend in some way, and it has changed, it's undoubtedly changed it. It was interesting during COVID, when you couldn't have Anzac Day, thousands of people around the country assembling on their driveway at dawn, having little commemorations, the whole dawn service at the Anzac. I went to a couple of dawn services at the Anzac Day when there were a few thousand people there. Now, it's unbelievable. There are kind of tens and tens of thousands of people turn up at dawn to the shrine though. So it's really, really grown into something quite different.
It's interesting because it also coincided, 1996 was when John Howard came to power. It also coincided with travel to Turkey.
It was too.
And
it
Anzac
too.
Cove.
It must have been... Oh, I'm an error there, isn't it? It would have been Keating then for the 50th anniversary. But anyway, Howard was a big proponent of it. Keating was a bit of an iconoclast, wasn't he? He sort of made us remember that, you know, the kind of British betrayal at the fall of Singapore and all that kind of. So he was a bit of a rabble rouser, but Howard really, I think, turned it into something more sort of sacred and different and relevant to a younger generation.
My understanding is that any final decision to approve the use of the word ANZAC actually rests with the Minister for Veteran Affairs or the Minister's delegate. Not everyone can use the word ANZAC. I mean, they can commercially use it for biscuits and the production of ANZAC biscuits, but not everyone can just say, hey, this is an ANZAC special.
Wow. Well, I did not know that, but that is an indication that it's become very much commodified, isn't it? I mean, the beauty of Anzac Day in the past was it was for its scale, it was one kind of huge public event and ceremony that nobody was making a buck out of. I don't know if that's still the case anymore. I mean, that's what made it unique. It had a kind of a purity to it. Now it is a much more of a commercial venture, I think. Yes, the football match, just the kind of general, there's Anzac Day merch now that there never used to be. There are books and T-shirts and people buy Anzac Day T-shirts and wear them on the day. I actually was just down the shops and there are people wearing them already.
Enterprise. Wake up. Shake up your business.
And to round things off, how important is it to you that things that you buy, that you consume, are actually made in Australia or grown in Australia or have some incredibly important component of them that's generated here on these shores? Perhaps you go around scouring the shelves and shops for things that show that little green triangle with the abstract kangaroo that signifies Australian made. We caught up with what Australian made actually means with Ben Lazzaro from the Australian Made organisation, and he told us stuff about what it takes to qualify as Australian made that would really blow your wheat fields away.
To carry an Australian grown claim, that's quite straightforward, as you pointed out. We grow the product here, it comes out of the ground or off the tree. That's an easy one. To make a made in Australia claim in Australia, is essentially you have to satisfy a rule that's in the Australian consumer law, which is called the substantial transformation test. And you touched on it there before, where you can bring in components from overseas, and as long as you've demonstrated that you've substantially transformed them into something new in identity and essential character.
Mm-hmm.
And a good example of that might be that you could import timber into Australia and turn that into a tables and chairs, and you could legally describe that as Australian made, and then you could apply to carry that famous green and gold kangaroo. If you were to simply import those preformed components of the table and chair and assemble them here, that would not comply.
IKEA does not comply.
Quite right. Most of it, I would say off the cuff, most likely would not.
However, if I bought some timber from the Brazilian rainforest, imported the timber, and in a lovely, cool little workshop in Paddington, say, in New South Wales, or up in Fortitude Valley, built myself an artisan dining room table, that would be Australian. Made.
Spot on. You've substantially transformed those components. They weren't a table when they came in.
Mm-mm.
You've turned them into a beautiful table, as you described.
What does it do for a business to get that stamp, that green stamp? Is it an asset, or does it imply that it's more expensive, or, you know, like, what does it mean?
Well, it means different things for different businesses in depending on the sector you're in. So we deal with the logos registered across all 34 classes of goods in Australia. So our compliance team, it's what keeps the job interesting. We're assessing that table and chair, as I mentioned before. We could then be assessing a truck. Food is
different.
I can talk about that, but a product for a baby, a health product. And so those businesses will use it. They might be exporting overseas. So they go, I've got to be known as being Australian when I get into the Southeast Asian market.
Because
so that's where the value is.
Because that's a good sales pitch.
Sign of quality, ethical labour, high production standards.
Mm.
Another business might want to use it in their B2B operations, put it on their tender documents and say, hey, if you want to meet local production quantities, then I'm an Australian product and I'll help you get there as a project manager. So there's all these different reasons and what value it adds to the product. But what it does universally, as we described before, it says it's genuinely Australian. It's a third-party accreditation, which is more powerful than the business itself making the claim. It's we've gone out to some third-party experts and they've verified that our product is Australian-made. And that's why you and I and many others out there see that green and gold kangaroo logo. And we might not necessarily understand what made in Australia means. No one wants to think about substantial transformation, but they know it means it's a genuine Aussie product and they can buy with confidence.
So they can buy with confidence that it's been made with either labour laws that are correct, that superannuation will have been paid, that it's got good workmanship. The value, but what surprises me about the application of this logo is that it's a not-for-profit organisation. Why is that? What is the background to this whole organisation?
Yeah, so the organisation was put together in 1999, and that was with the cooperation of the federal government and chambers of commerce. Mm-hmm. So originally in 86, the logo was developed. Ken Kodo designed it for a Labor government. And as I said, in 1999, they actually spun it out into a not-for-profit organisation that we now run. Mm-hmm. And I think what's important about that is governments, particularly at the time, don't want to be seen to be prosecuting by local campaigns because of free trade agreements. And you can upset some of those.
Some of our trading partners.
Yes, that's right.
So they put an arm's length accreditation on it. So it's like, it's not us.
That's right. And it technically isn't them either because it's not funded by government. It's funded by licence fees. So businesses pay a small licence fee.
Oh, to get it, do they?
To get it, that's right. 0.1% of what they turn over. It's next to nothing. Not to be flipping about expenses the business have to pay. So if you're turning over $300,000 worth of pens that you're making here, then that license is $300 for the year.
Right.
And it maxes out at $25,000 and you have to be turning over $45 million at that point. And those fees haven't gone up for a decade. And I challenge anyone to find anything where a price hasn't gone up for 10 years. And that's quite intentional because our organisation wants to make this available to businesses at the small end of the scale and all the way up to the big.
How does it benefit the business internationally to have the logo on it?
Depending on the market you're going in, but almost certainly because of Australia's reputation of being a positive place not only to visit, but products that come out of it are known for their quality and our standards and our clean, green environment.
So we've got a good brand.
We've got a good brand anyway. So to then demonstrate that you're from this place that has this wonderful reputation can only be positive. And within certain sectors, there's a higher understanding. If you take complementary medicines, for example, if you want to sell vitamins or health products into the Asian market, then you must have the green and gold kangaroo on there or something that demonstrates your Australianness into that market, because that is one of the things that they will look at and associate all those, you know, quality aspects to when you're competing against other European brands, American brands and so on. So being known as Australian in most parts of the world is an advantage.
And there's no guarantee that you'll get the accreditation just because you've got the money to pay.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
It's certainly quite stringent.
Yeah, you're quite right. So we have a compliance team that assesses the product, and that's the fun thing, in inverted commas, about the substantial transformation test, is it is subjective.
I get the substantial transformation.
But that
test is
subjective. So we are making determinations on that. You as a business owner might come to me and say, I absolutely make this thing here. And we go, well, we've got a ton of experience in this space and I don't feel comfortable giving you the logo because we don't think you meet the test. And in a roundabout way, we're actually providing, I think, a service to that organisation saying you should not make a Made in Australia claim because you may end up in some legal troubles.
So there you go. Another little podcast from your breakfast team. My name is Libby Gore. George Denikian joins me 7 to 9 with business news headlines. And together with the team, we love to give you a breakfast show that kind of makes the money day make sense. We're here to help you take care of business and to get shit done. I do hope you can join us on the radio, or you can go to Disrupt Radio on the web for great more content, including this podcast and other program highlights.
Disrupt Radio. Tune in to opportunity.